It's another midweek recording in the thick of things.
Yeah, this is weird. And it's a midweek recording, and we're also on very different schedules because I'm assuming you woke up a few hours ago.
I woke up at 6 my time.
Okay. It's like 7 hours ago.
Many hours ago.
I woke up at 4 p.m. It's now 10:11 a.m.
Can't do. I know that's not me. My body a little like it'll put me to sleep. It like choke me out on the floor.
Well, I haven't really been awake that many hours. I've been awake a pretty normal human amount of hours, like 16-ish hours.
But I feel like getting myself to the point where I would have an inverse schedule, it would be very difficult for me to do that because I hit a certain point and it's like I run into an actual wall and it's over. So I just go to bed and wake up early. It works for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish I could do that. It seems a lot simpler. I just tend to gravitate towards these, like, I guess, like, longer schedules where it's, I don't remember, there's a name for it, but where you're not on, like, a 24-hour cycle, where your body's on a longer cycle, like a 26 or a 30-hour cycle instead.
I've never been on one of those cycles.
It's pretty weird, Sean.
I've always been, I've always just been an early riser, always, and when I was younger, I could stay up much later. Now, I kind of know when my limit is, and I know if I stay up and much later, I know that tomorrow I'll just be tired all day. So I've kind of learned that. But the early rising thing has never changed. I think it's because when I was really young, we'd go visit my grandparents, and my grandpa would always play video games on the computer, like 4 o'clock in the morning, and I would always get up and watch him play like the original Warcraft before it became MMO.
Nice.
Original Warcraft, and he would play the original Age of Empires before you could even queue units and stuff like that.
I also played the original Age of Empires a lot at 4 a.m. It was just approaching it from the other direction again.
Yeah, I played that a ton. He played that all the time. I don't know, he played a lot of different stuff, and so I would always kind of get up and join him while he was doing that, and then he would go to bed. So he would get up and then go to sleep at like 8 a.m. just like have an early morning session and then go to sleep, and I would just stay awake and play. So yeah, I played a lot of Age of Empires early in the morning.
Yeah, a lot of those games from that, I guess that kind of era, I find stuck with me so much, especially the RTSs, like Age of Empires, Rise of the Nations. Of course, so much time in Age of Empires 2, building all those walls everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Age of Empires 2 expansion, you could tunnel through. So like you could play the Black Forest map, and if you got the right catapults, you could tear down trees, so you could just tunnel behind people because they would never build walls back there, and it always worked. It almost always worked.
Yeah, I feel like in some ways that was a bit of a golden age of gaming, just because you look at so many of those games and what they did. They had so little to work with, but they still achieved gameplay that was so in depth and addictive. Like people got sucked into those as much as they get into sucked into any game now, right? Like these games now have huge, deep storylines and plots and all that, but not necessarily any more value for the person. And that's something I've been thinking about a lot lately, is like trying to provide a lot without overwhelming, right? So does that make any sort of sense?
Yeah, I get what you're saying. And I, funnily enough, I was listening to a podcast with Merlin Mann. What's it called? It's Due by Friday with Merlin Mann and Max Temkin and Alex. I don't know her last name. But they were talking about how when they use something, they just want it to work. They don't want all the extra features. They don't want a ton of things. They don't want to be overwhelmed. They just want it to work, period. And then anything above and beyond that is kind of extra for them. And I can kind of see that, like figuring out, you know, how you provide a lot without it becoming confusing and hard to navigate and hard to understand, I think is a big thing. And I think that something that's spread out too much and hard to understand is almost like a bug, you know?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. But I kind of bring this actually back to web dev. I've been looking back at those games in what I've been doing a lot of for Nest Notes. So this week I've been doing a bunch of work on this flow where you can select prints for ordering and like resize and crop them and all that kind of stuff. I've been figuring that out in my head, kind of like what that should look like and how that should flow. And now I'm actually on the implementation side of things finally. And it's kind of amazing when you go around and look at all the different interfaces out there for editing photos on the web, especially when you're designing them for print or like laying them out for print, how overcomplicated things can get easily. You end up with 30 buttons without even thinking about it, because there are so many operations you can do on these sorts of things. But then really consolidating that down and taking a bit more time to be like, okay, is there any way I can remove this method of cropping and just make it this one? Or is there any way I can make something automatic or make some buttons disappear in different modes? I'm just finding a lot of value in taking that little bit of extra time lately.
Yeah, it's so easy just to find some library out there and throw it in. And, you know, like your boss or some customer is like, hey, we want this feature, and you're probably busy doing other things. Or you have lots on your plate. So you're like, okay, let's find this cropping library and toss it in. And it provides all these options. Maybe we don't need them. We're just going to throw it in anyway, so we can call it done and close the issue. I find myself fighting that temptation quite a bit, knowing that there are tools that are already written out there for me to use that provide lots of things. And I might not need half of them, but I include it anyway, just so that I can call something done or be done with it, because there's other things that I'm focusing on.
Well, I don't even think, I mean, there are, for the cropping stuff on NestNotes as an example, I am using a library for that. I'm using Cropper.js, which so far has been super, super cool. I really like it, just as a side note. But and I think really what I'm getting at here is not so much that you should or shouldn't necessarily use a library, but if you do use a library, you should make sure that you really tailor it as much as possible to suit the exact needs of what you're trying to do. So Cropper does have some features that I'm not using, and it has some things that I've enabled or disabled or tweaked as necessary. And it's gone from being like kind of okay feeling to like pretty nice now. It feels like I don't want to say native because there are connotations, but it feels like a very integrated part of the application. It feels like something that belongs there, right?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, by all means, if there's a library that solves a problem for you, then I think it's fine. It's just that it's kind of like the whole jQuery soup idea, I guess, that I was brought up on. Like, you just toss everything in and use only parts, you know? It's kind of like, I've been buying these chickens lately, Paul, and I'll roast them myself, and then I'll eat all the meat, and then I'll take the bones and I'll boil them into broth. So I'm using like everything, every part of it that I can. Whereas I'm sure a lot of people might buy one of those chickens and then take some of it off and then throw all this other stuff away. It's kind of like wasteful almost. So I feel like people are wasting resources by they're bringing all these projects in, or these dependencies. They're bringing in lots of dependencies and never really using what's there.
Yeah. And I mean, this is something that the web has gotten, I think, better about, because there was a point in time where it was pretty common to open up a web development project and there would be, you know, a couple versions of jQuery in the source, plus like one that was linked from somewhere else for a different website, and maybe MooTools and possibly Prototype as well. And so like we've definitely come a long way with the modern tooling and how much you can kind of limit things that are included to only what you're actually using. But there is still such a tendency, I think, in developers in general to just always include everything, because it's easy. I mean, it's easy to include everything, right?
Yeah, it's easy. What's interesting is that I feel like a lot of us developers are kind of always in a hurry. We always feel like we're in a hurry to get something done that we're working on. Whatever we want to do, we want to do it as fast as we can. And then that kind of feeds into that whole thing that we've been talking about. But I think it was this morning, I was looking on Twitter, and the people that are working on Cushion App, they are rolling out to public beta a time tracking feature. And so I've been watching them post GIFs on Twitter just about this feature. And they mentioned that their original timeline to build this thing out was 2 months. And at first I was like, huh, that seems like a good amount of time to build out a feature like this. And then they said, you know, we're glad that we spent an extra month on it. So it ended up taking 3 months. And so then I was thinking to myself, 3 months? When was the last time I had 3 months to build not just like a thing, but build a feature for a thing? And I don't remember. And I think part of that is honestly my fault, because when someone asks me, how long is it going to take? I stupidly always say, oh, I could probably do it in this much time without thinking through it or budgeting extra.
Well, I think there's a little bit of multiple things at play there though, right? Because a lot of the times, and I've been very aware of many of the projects you've worked on, at least, a lot of times the people who say, you know, how long will this take? There is an implicit understanding that of the maximum length that you can reply with acceptably, right? and this is a common thing with all client work. And that's a tough thing, but it is being honest with yourself and with your clients about estimates is such a difficult thing. Something I still struggle with for sure.
Yeah, it was just funny because it was like it's just kind of like a thought that popped in my head. I was like, man, 3 months, like they killed it. The feature looks great, but 3 months to do that. And I'm sure there's much more to the implementation that I have no idea about. Because I, you know, obviously haven't seen any code, or I basically know that it's running on Sinatra because I asked Johnny. I was like, hey, what's your what are you using? You know, and they said Sinatra and Vue. But yeah, I don't know. It was just a funny thought that popped in my head. I was like, 3 months, dang, that seems like a nice time frame to have to build something out well and test it the right way anyway.
Yeah. 3 months for a feature is, that sounds lovely.
Yeah. Maybe it's just because we're both also in startup mode too, where we're like, we got to get this thing out and, make some money so we can keep our jobs. So I'm kind of in a spot now where the Rails app, I mentioned, cutting like the RAM usage down. I think it was like in a third or something like that. And so it's all right. And so basically I talked to my coworkers and I said, hey, you know, I think that there's some things that we need to do, some restructuring, some rebuilding that we need to do going forward, thinking about, you know, how much money that you're wanting to put into like advertising and how much traffic we already have right now. There's some things that we could do to make sure that we're more bulletproof for the future. And so what's cool is they're letting me spend time on this. And I know that I've been talking about Elixir and Go recently, and I've settled on Elixir. And so I've spent a good number of hours, a many number of hours in the past week and a half building out stuff in Elixir. And it's nice, but I at the same time, I feel rushed because there's like small tweaks and changes that I make to the Rails app every day. And so every time I make one of those, I think to myself, oh, I'm just adding to the pile of things that needs to be done on the Elixir side.
Right. Oh, yeah. Doing a language migration as a solo developer, I can't even imagine. That's why I haven't done any of that stuff actually for NestNotes. It's just because there's just no way.
Yeah. I feel like I'm in a unique situation where I inherited something that worked mostly, and then I kind of bolted stuff onto it, and now it's running well. And I'm finding that in rebuilding things. So basically what I did was I cloned down a database and then I copied it and I hooked up I hooked up Ecto to it, and I'm matching the schema one for one for things. But what's been really nice is that I have a much greater understanding of the Rails app now, because in the Rails app, I obviously don't want to like take out the foundation because I don't really know everything that touches, but I'm kind of free to do that here because it, you know, I'm kind of building from the ground up. So there's not like a lot of unknowns that could happen if I change X or Y. So it's been nice, but I just need to shake that feeling of, I got to get this done, like this feeling of urgency. And I don't think that urgency is necessarily a bad thing, but it's kind of forcing me into that feeling busy mode, which I don't think is necessarily that healthy in my situation anyway.
So I participated in Ludum Dare over the last weekend. It was the 38th Ludum Dare. They've been doing it for 15 years now, which is crazy. They do three every year, I guess.
Oh, they do three a year? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's once every 4 months. But anybody who doesn't know, Ludum Dare is a pretty well-known game jam. Basically, like we said, it's every 4 months, and people get together over a weekend. And you could do this as a solo developer in 48 hours, creating all of the assets, so all the graphics, all of the sound, all of the everything, except for code. You can use code. It just has to be open sourced. And there's also a second version where teams can join, so it can be more than one person to do different, you know, different roles or combine roles or however they want to set it up, and they get 72 hours instead. So it's either from 6 p.m. on Friday to 6 p.m. on Sunday for solo devs, or from 6 p.m. on Friday to 6 p.m. on Monday for a team. And so the 48-hour one is called the compo, and the other one's called the jam. There's some slightly different rules between the two.
So I remember you messaging me over the weekend when you're working on it, and you said that this was something that tested every skill that you have as a developer to the max.
Yeah. It was awesome, first of all. It was super, super fun. I'm going to be doing it again in the future and hopefully other game jams as well. So this resulted in, I did the 48-hour version solo, and it resulted in actually the first game that I've ever published. I know I announced Microcosm a few weeks ago, but I hadn't actually released a game publicly until now. So now I've got that under my belt, and we'll get a link to that in show notes. You can play it in your browser. It's WebGL and whatnot. But it really does stretch just every single developer muscle. Like, it exercises it for sure. Because you're thinking about user flows. Like, you're looking at how people are going to interact with the thing and how you can structure it to encourage certain types of interactions. And then of course you're actually developing things. You're just writing, you know, plain old writing code. You're having to generate art assets. You have to generate like static art assets for things like the marketing page and that sort of thing. You have to pick out color palettes. You have to do, it's like every kind of thing. You have to do copywriting. It's any kind of creative muscle just gets exercised a lot. It's really kind of astounding how many different things you have to do in order to make a game come together.
So how did you come up with your idea, Boosters Day Out? I think it was, I mean, because you're really into Unity right now, which I think is awesome. And, you know, they have the 3D environment and physics and stuff like that. Was it just an extension of that?
So each Ludum Dare, they have a theme that gets announced as the competition starts. So like nobody knows, people get to vote on what the theme should be leading up, but nobody really knows until it actually goes live. So you can't like prepare too much. But the theme this time was a small world. And initially going into it, I was thinking just that if I could figure out one that worked with the theme, I was going to try to do like a 3D platformer. And so when a small world was announced, I was like, okay, it's going to be a 3D platformer, like kind of Super Mario Galaxy, like for anybody who knows that, I'm sure most people, where you're on a little planet and you run around it and you can jump to other planets. That's that kind of thing. And I played around with that a little bit and kind of got a prototype mm-hmm. working, and wasn't super happy with it, but I was really enjoying like the gravity part of it, like the physics bit. And then I was like, well, I can just make it into a rocket ship instead, I guess. And you just fly around other planets, and then maybe it's like, it's three dimensional, but you're looking at it straight on. So it's like semi two dimensional. And so it was just a bunch of different little planets because right. the theme was a small world. And so I was like, you just fly, you land, go from planet to planet, trying to get to your home planet. That was pretty much it.
It turned out pretty fun, yeah.
And it seemed fun, so I just ran with it.
Yeah, I played it quite a bit when you first showed it to me. Actually, I think, yeah, I recorded the first flight, didn't I?
Yep.
I can't even remember what I did. I think it just exploded.
You flew around for a surprisingly long time.
Yeah, it was pretty fun. It was cool. Like, it was pretty cool that I think you sent me a bundle, right, first, and then you sent me a WebGL version of it, which I thought was really sick.
Yeah, when I was developing it, I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to use the Unity WebGL export because I just hadn't messed with it before, so I wasn't sure if there were a ton of limitations or if it just sucked or whatever. But no, later on, I just tried it. I was like, well, I need to figure out how I'm distributing this, if it's going to be like just a Mac app or if I'm doing a Windows build or what. And I was like, oh, I guess I'll just try the WebGL version. And it runs pretty great, like surprisingly great.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. I thought it was really cool that they had that feature anyway, that you could just export it and then throw it up on a website.
Yeah. It's new-ish. I mean, they had the Unity web player before, but I mean, it required a browser plugin. And basically, browser plugins are all deprecated now. So you can't really use that. And a couple of years ago, right. they started betaing, I think like 2015-ish, they started betaing the WebGL one. And now it like automatically compiles everything with ASM, and it's really, really well optimized.
Yeah, that's really cool. I remember the Unity web player because I tried to play a game. I think it was Star Citizen. Maybe it wasn't Star Citizen. Maybe it was something similar to that. But I got frustrated with the plugin and just gave up and never went back. But I think that's really cool. I mean, it makes sense. It only makes sense that they would do that.
Oh, right. Yeah, I'm just kind of amazed that the technology is there. Like, when you actually go to the Unity site and look at the docs for the WebGL mode, there are limitations to it, but they're surprisingly few. It's pretty full featured.
What would be an example of the limitations?
I had some certain things with like the lighting engine, and there are things with where you can save data, obviously, because you're in a web browser. But it's mostly just stuff like that. There's not like major things missing, really.
Gotcha. That's pretty cool, though. It sounds interesting to me, and I really want to give it a try. I just don't. It's just another to piggyback on last episode. It's just another straw on the camel.
Right. Well, and I mean, especially when you're already in the middle of learning Elixir, so that's a whole thing too, and a whole ecosystem to get familiar with.
It's been good though. So I mean, I think the reason it's been sticking is because I've been learning it for a while, just little bit by little bit. And so now I'm just kind of jumped in, and I think honestly that working on DK so much, like the back end side of things, allowed me to learn Elixir better because it made me more familiar. So as I was diving into more straight Ruby instead of Ruby in the context of Rails, learning more about object oriented programming, it kind of allowed me to jump over to Elixir. Even though it's not object oriented, it helped me with the fundamentals of just small modules and small methods and things like that. So it seems really well. And I mean, I'm using Phoenix, but the cool thing is that Phoenix doesn't feel all encompassing. So a good portion of my application is actually just Elixir, and it just happens to be that I'm using Phoenix for my controllers and stuff. So like all my models, like what's cool is that it's not even really an ORM, but even like the database persistence layer, it's not even Phoenix, it's Ecto, which is something else. So models aren't even tied to Phoenix at all. You just have an Elixir file, you pull in the Ecto stuff, and you define a schema, which is cool. But so I think that's also helping me, is because it's not a giant monolithic thing to learn. It's kind of like a couple of smaller things that play together really well, and it's been helping me out a lot. So I'm actually to a point now where I feel productive. Like I feel like I can just get stuff done, and I'm not having to look things up all the time.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it didn't take that long at all.
I mean, going back to your point, we've covered this before, of course, but going back to your point about learning things in Ruby helping you do things in Elixir, that is such an important thing for sure. We need to keep hammering on that, because learning new languages, the more languages you learn, the easier it is to learn new languages. The more development patterns and things you learn, the easier it is to learn more. I've never had an experience where I like ran out of room, right? Where things got pushed out. Every new piece of information kind of bolsters and reinforces the others. In fact, at least in my experience. So I feel like sometimes people are hesitant to learn new things because they're worried about that, right? But I just want to encourage people that if you are thinking about like trying something new out, if you are thinking about like doing a game jam, for example, you should probably do that. You should probably do that and soon because it really, just learning new things and diving into new stuff really is such a solid way to improve your existing skills. And also maybe find some stuff you really like doing too.
Well, I mean, it just improves your life quality, I think. I mean, I hear a lot of people when you say something like, oh, you should give this a try. A lot of people will say, I don't think I could do that. I don't think I'm able to do that, which I think is a load of crap anyway. You know, bet on yourself and do it. But like you said, it's a good way to find new hobbies. It's a good way to learn more about things that you already know, because it gives you a different perspective. That applies to almost every aspect in life. You know, if there's something that you might want to try it out. I've been wanting to try jiu-jitsu for a while, so I was like, I'm going to do it. So I started going to classes, and I'm getting my butt kicked every other night. But it's fun. And I found another hobby, that something that I really enjoy and something that actually enriches my life. Whereas previously, I would have thought to myself, oh, I don't think I need to do that because, you know, you have to start from the ground and you don't know anything. Like, I don't know what the crap I'm doing, but I'm going, you know, and I'm enjoying it. So I think what's cool is that principle applies to everything. It applies to every facet of life.